Welcome to The Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My guest today is political scientist and American Enterprise Institute resident scholar Norman Ornstein, who I spoke to back in March about his book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. This September, Dr. Ornstein released a new book, co-authored with Thomas Mann and E.J. Dionne, titled One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, which we'll be talking about today. Dr. Ornstein, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
You know, your books previous to this have focused on the increasingly dysfunctional nature of Congress. And I'm wondering, do you see One Nation Under Trump as a change in focus or maybe more of a natural extension of the broken branch and it's even worse than it looks?
I think it may be a little bit of both. For a while, I would joke that Tom and I had done the broken branch, how Congress is failing America and how to get it back on track. And then the next one, that was 2006, and 2012 was It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. And we updated that in 2016 to It's Even Worse Than It Was. And I would tell people that my next one might be called Run for Your Lives. But we changed. And of course, some of the trends that we have seen, the broken branch was about the erosion of norms and the almost demolishment of the regular order in Congress, the process by which you have an open debate and deliberation, you have opportunities for input and amendments from not just members of the minority party, but rank and file members of one's own party. You have a process that includes a House and Senate passing bills that may be different, and then going to a conference committee and openly, at least for the most part, working out differences before sending something on to the president. You have rules along with the norms that respect the nature of the process. And those had deteriorated very, very substantially going back certainly to the 1970s and accelerated with the advent of Newt Gingrich in 1979. And both parties played a significant role. By 2012, we were looking at a much sharper deterioration. And what we had seen earlier, of course, a polarization in views in Congress as the parties sorted in a way. The conservative Southerners, once called the Bull Weevils, then the Blue Dogs, sharply diminished in number. Moderate Republicans, once called Gypsy Moths, close to disappearing as the regions transformed. But polarization can still bring you problem solving. And then we saw really the emergence in a big way of tribalism. And what we saw, and it's even worse than it looks, was that the tribalism was certainly there in the political institutions and in Congress and greatly exacerbated with the election of Barack Obama. But it had metastasized downward to the states and out to the country as a whole, and accompanied by a very, very troubling racial element that was itself amplified by the so-called birther movement, which is almost in-your-face racism. And of course, its major champion was then a talk show barker and real estate mogul, using the term loosely, named Donald Trump. It had gotten sharper and worse by 2016. The re-election of Obama didn't make any difference, even though he won by quite a substantial margin. And now what we've seen is, of course, a Trump presidency. And some of those trends continued and amplified. But I think it's also that we could have had these sorts of developments and seen real problems in policymaking. Let's say, for example, that without the Comey letters, the Russian interference, perhaps Hillary Clinton winning a very narrow presidential victory with at least a Republican House of Representatives, probably a narrow margin, maybe Republican majority in the Senate, maybe not. But either way, we would have seen continued tribal divisions inside Congress, an inability to come together on significant legislation. The old process, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said, where we don't make social policy without broad leadership consensus, gone by the boards. This takes us into a different territory, though, and it's a territory where you have to fear for the continuation of the republic. And that perhaps was not just a natural continuation of trends.
Right. Now, that kind of brings us up to, I think, November of 2016. And you start One Nation Under Trump actually by looking at Trumpian misconceptions related to sort of what his election meant and what it didn't mean. What, in brief, do you think his election did mean? That is it sort of giving the go-ahead to this sort of polarization and tribalism, or something more, or something less, maybe?
I think it's also maybe a little bit of both. You know, we suggest, among other things, that the institutions are creating a real problem in terms of how they are working relative to what the framers had in mind. The Electoral College from 1824, I should say, which was really the beginning of anything resembling a popular vote, up until and through 1996, 172 years, 44 elections. We had arguably three where there was some question about whether the winner of a popular vote was the winner of the presidency. One, Grover Cleveland, where it was clear, one out of 44, and now it's been two out of five. And an electoral college that was originally supposed to have sober-minded individuals, all men, provide a check and balance against a president without principles or untethered, of course, has changed dramatically. But the bias in the electoral college that moves us further away from a popular vote winner being reflected has become much more sharp. A ratio from smallest to largest states of 13 to 1, largest to smallest states, is now 70 to 1. We have distortions in the system and distortions in other places. The notion that Trump was a populist avatar was a great misconception. And of course, we've seen a set of policies culminating in tax bill that has not yet been enacted into law as we speak, but also through the attempts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act that we call a phony populism in a subsequent chapter. But the idea that Trump won because he swept the white working class vote, also a misconception. Trump's bases of support, as we've seen in a very cogent paper by Emily Eakins at the Cato Institute, had many different elements, including highly educated and wealthy individuals, including those whose main concerns were not economic but social, and those who were ardently free enterprise, something that Trump in no way ran on. There are a whole host of areas where our sense of what Trump meant and how he got elected have been, I think, distorted. And now some of the realities are emerging, although for many of his ardent supporters who get their information from different sources than I do and perhaps you do, Michael, none of that may matter.
Yeah. So I guess what you're suggesting is, you know, when I think of populists, at least in American politics, I think of people like Andrew Jackson or Huey Long, those sort of people. And you're saying that it sounds like that Donald Trump really isn't actually in that mold at all.
Donald Trump may be a little bit in the Huey Long mold because there was certainly a bit of an authoritarian edge to him, and a bit of the I am the one who can fix this. But there is a real difference. And of course, we've seen populism emerge throughout the course of American history. It's deeply embedded. There's a populism on the left, there's a populism on the right, and as we saw in 1992, the left-wing populism of Ralph Nader and the right-wing populism of Pat Buchanan was matched and exceeded by the centrist populism of H. Ross Perot. And it usually brings with it protectionism and isolationism and a touch of nativism. When Perot talked about that giant sucking sound of jobs going to Mexico, there was nativism and protectionism wrapped up into one. And Trump reflects some of that in his rhetoric. But I think at least for much of the populism through American history, there was a genuine sense of the people against the elites, of working class people against economic elites. Trump applied that rhetoric during the campaign, but meant none of it, it's clear. And the policies that he and his allies and partners in Congress have pursued have no element of populism to them at all.
Right. Certainly the tax bill doesn't seem like the sort of economic populism that one would expect. I want to ask you a little bit about truthfulness in presidents, you know, of course, or politicians in general. Now, politicians have always misrepresented the truth, cherry-picked facts, that sort of thing. And when I bring this point up, a lot of conservatives still to this day like to point out that before the Affordable Care Act was passed, President Obama famously told people, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. And so when I accuse President Trump of being the most, the biggest liar in modern political history, people point that out and just say, well, he's just continuing that trend. Everyone does it. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, what do you think about that? Is what President Trump is doing significantly different or just sort of a continuation?
In a way, that argument would be like saying of somebody who is a repeated hit-and-run DUI driver, yeah, but look at the other guy. He once went 40 in a 30 zone. Donald Trump is unique among presidents in many ways, but particularly unique in being a serial liar. If you go to Glenn Kessler, the fact checker for the Washington Post, who was no fan of Barack Obama, what you have is a president now who has flat out lied an average of 5 times a day during the course of his first 10 and a half months in the presidency. And some of the lies are completely contradict what he said earlier. Some of them are so blatant and in your face that it almost takes your breath away. But we've never seen anything like this. Your initial point, Michael, is a valid one. Not just politicians, but anybody in a position of influence, but certainly with politicians, is going to try and make the strongest case that person can. And that does involve often either cherry-picking facts or taking a position that itself might be technically accurate, but that doesn't reflect the larger environment. One of the things that Kessler does with his fact checker, which has Pinocchios ranging from a modest lie or a distortion of one all the way up to 4, is very careful to calibrate based on whether there is a substantial element of truth here, but not the whole truth, and so on. And nobody has gotten anywhere close to, in fact, there's no competition for individuals who've gotten 4 Pinocchios. So this is a completely different kind of president. And one thing you know is when he says surrounding a statement, believe me, that's a pretty clear indication that you should not believe him. If he says it twice, that means not just 4 Pinocchios, but 8 Pinocchios.
Today's sponsor is Dollar Shave Club. By now, you've heard me talk about the amazing shave I get from my Dollar Shave Club razor, especially when I use it with their most excellent Dr. Carver's Shave Butter. And now they have even more great products for your daily routine. They've got products for your hair, for your face, for your skin, the shower, even butt wipes. I mean, everything you need. And it's all their own original stuff with premium ingredients delivered right to your door, so you don't have to deal with those annoying trips to the store. Jay and I want you to love Dollar Shave Club as much as we do. So we've arranged for you to try your first month of their best razor, along with travel-sized versions of shave butter, body cleanser, and yes, even butt wipes for just $5. And after that, replacement cartridges ship for just a few bucks a month. It's the Dollar Shave Club starter set. Get yours for just $5 exclusively at dollarshaveclub.com/TPG. That's dollarshaveclub.com/TPG. Now, you know, one other way, of course, that President Trump is very different is he's a lot cruder. He's a lot more informal, at least in public, than any president, I think, in modern history. And of course, to many Trump supporters, they see that as a breath of, you know, fresh air. And I'm wondering if you see a downside to this. I mean, are things like gravitas or presidential demeanor, do those things really matter? Or are they just prejudices of a political elite who doesn't like being questioned?
You've hit on an important point here. There is built into American culture a distrust of politicians. It's often been a kind of healthy skepticism, and the sense that somebody doesn't speak in politispeak, that somebody talks just like the average person, reflects a kind of reality that you don't see with people who are almost like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. And that is a significant part of Trump's appeal. There's also no question that we've had presidents who, in their private demeanor, were exceptionally crude. Richard Nixon, I think a lot of people, when they heard the tapes, were just plain shocked at the language that he used, at the crude anti-Semitism and racism that he sometimes displayed. If you look at the recent movie by Rob Reiner, LBJ, it very accurately portrays the kind of crude language that LBJ routinely used in private and sometimes behavior. But nobody's done it in a public fashion like Trump. They did not lie in the fashion that Trump does. And there's a real difference here. And certainly, a lot of Trump's behavior is discounted by those who are ardent supporters of his because they say he is just like the guy in the bar. But, you know, presidents set the tone for the nation. Presidents really do shape the way others behave. And one of the things that we've seen is a growing crudeness and vitriol in the country as a whole. Was there before, but it has been amplified by Donald Trump. And what we also haven't seen generally in our presidents is somebody who deliberately pits one group against the other, who goes after his defeated opponent, who makes no attempt to represent the entire nation. And we also see a president who has systematically alienated other world leaders, including despoiling at best the special relationship with our very close and important ally, Great Britain. We haven't seen anything like this before.
You know, I'm trying to find a positive note, at least for liberal listeners. And here's one I want to run by you. In the past, I've suggested that maybe in one sense, liberals, my fellow liberals, should be glad Donald Trump was elected, at least opposed to, say, like a John Kasich or a Ted Cruz. And my reasoning is, while a lot of the basic policy positions are very similar, the inexperience, the ineptitude, and sort of the outrageous behavior of President Trump make him far less effective at enacting that conservative agenda, but also make it more possible that we might see Democratic wave elections in 2018 and 2020 than we would under what you'd call a normal Republican president. I mean, Am I grasping at straws here? What do you think?
Well, you might not expect it from what I've set up till now, but our book with E.J. Dionne and Tom Mann actually has an optimistic tone to it. And it's based on a couple of things. One is a sense that Trump has given us a double jolt. And in the first instance, a necessary jolt. And the first part is that we were going back to trends, and not just political trends, but broader societal trends. We were seeing deep sectarian and other divisions emerging over a long period of time, driven in part by economic inequality, by a growing racial and regional divide, by this sense of a division not just between firmly red and firmly blue states, but within states between the more vibrant, economically driven metropolitan areas with the people who have education that gives them opportunities, and the more rural areas that have been economically stagnant with people who don't have the opportunities and may never have them. And you put all of that together with the move towards a more diverse nation and ultimately a majority of minorities in the country. And if we had not had this jolt now, we could have gone along just with deterioration to a point of no return where, you know, getting a unity back in the country would have been nearly impossible. Now we have an opportunity, and we have large numbers of groups out there trying to figure out ways to heal some of these wounds or bind things. The second, of course, is the jolt that comes from having a president with a party of enablers who is authoritarian in nature, who is demolishing even more norms, who, you know, starts by calling the press the enemy of the people, moves to trying to take on the independent judiciary, has a cult of personality, only I can fix it. We don't need all these people in the State Department. I'm the only one who matters, and who's a kleptocrat. The jolt there is also bringing forward civic society, civil society. It's bringing groups and individuals and movements into the process. We saw it with the election in November of 2017 in Virginia and other places around the country. And it might well result in what I think is necessary right now, not in a speaking in a partisan way, but when you have a party, and let's face it, there are no angels here, but it's the Republican Party that has gone off the rails and now, you know, embracing a pedophile, which is a pretty shocking development, putting a tax bill through a process in the Senate that was just unconscionable. It takes some election defeats to jolt them back to being what will inevitably be a very conservative party, but a problem-solving party. What that will require is sustained effort on the part of activists, making sure that people turn out to vote and that they aren't seeing their votes suppressed unnaturally. It takes continued pressure on a Congress to do its job of providing a check and balance. And there's reason to be hopeful that at least some of those elements will emerge. But I think we should also be realistic. The damage being done here on the policy front with the jamming through of judges after blocking the slots while Obama was president, the damage to the diplomatic corps, for example, may take generations to repair. The number of tragedies of people being families being torn apart through a heartless and often mindless immigration process, of having poor children twisting in the wind, waiting to see if the very popular bipartisan children's health insurance program is reauthorized, the damage that's going to come through the healthcare demolishment deliberately done by the administration and the Republicans in Congress, Some of those things, there are going to be people who will never recover. But there's reason to believe that we're not just going to continue into a downward spiral inevitably. And of course, there's also the Mueller investigation that shows the best of an independent representative democracy.
I want to believe you. I really do. But I also want to point out, and this is something that you've mentioned in the past, and other political scientists as well. Hacker and Pearson have written a number of books, and saying that this is not just a recent phenomenon, but if we go back to, you mentioned Newt Gingrich earlier, where there was an explicit strategy to destroy faith in Congress as an institution and in the mainstream media in order to be able to say, look, this is a broken institution, let us take over it. I mean, that was a very successful strategy. And it seems to me that looking back over now more than two decades, it just seems like everyone has been doubling down on that strategy. And maybe, if I hear you right, you're saying maybe we've bottomed out. We've hit rock bottom at this point, and there's nowhere to go but up.
Well,
but I got to tell you, every time I think,
well,
yeah, exactly. Every time I think that, there's another low, like with the RNC just recently announcing that they were going to actually support Roy Moore now. And just every time I think it can't get worse, it turns out that I'm being overly optimistic.
I do think that there is simply no doubt that there's no low too low here, and it could get worse before it gets better. We need to be realistic here, and there are worst case scenarios ranging from a nuclear war to martial law that you can't say are completely out of the question. But it's also important to recognize that we have a pretty strong civil society tradition, the sense of the preciousness of our political system that can leave you at least feeling that there's a real chance that we can emerge from this and maybe even be stronger. And one part of it that I think we have to mention too is the number of very courageous conservatives and Republicans, most unfortunately not in elected office, who have stepped up and said, this is not my party. This is not the party that I expected to be supporting. Who are finding opportunities with their megaphones, in some cases with columns, with tweets, and in other ways with books, to make their views known and to make an attempt to recapture a conservative problem-solving and reasonable edge to a party. They may not succeed, and the fact is that some of those inside the institution who kind of feel the same way are the ones who are retiring. There's reason at least to be hopeful, if not optimistic.
Well, that's good. I just have one final question for you. I know we're running a little long. Some people on the left, most notably, I think, Vox's Ezra Klein, have started to make a case for what they've called normalizing presidential impeachment. And the argument, at least as I understand it, is that the framers never intended the presidency to be as powerful as it is. And with so much power and potential to do, well, extraordinary damage with that power now, we shouldn't be so reluctant to remove a president who's essentially unaccountable for 4 years. And I wanted to get your take on that argument.
I've read the piece and communicated with Ezra, who is one of the brightest lights we have in the world of journalism and discourse. And he's got some valid points to make. I'd written a piece earlier in the year about how we don't have a do-over clause in the Constitution. You know, what happens if there is an election that was illegally twisted and the result is or should be invalid? We don't have a way of dealing with that. I suggested that you could actually do that through the Presidential Succession Act, and not have to resort to a constitutional amendment. And that got me, by the way, on the list of the deep state enemies of Alex Jones. But I, you know, I'm a little reluctant to see impeachment become a normalized instrument. What's interesting now is that we're starting to see at least some people, including a few in the scholarly community, step up and say, Donald Trump can't commit obstruction of justice. John Yoo at Berkeley is one of them. And Trump has an absolute pardon power, including pardoning himself. And the remedy is impeachment. The problem we have now is we have a tribal Congress. And I'm not at all certain that there would be any set of conditions in which they would impeach Trump. I hope if it plays out that way, I'm wrong. And the reality, of course, is if you go back to Richard Nixon, most Republicans stuck with him until very close to the end. But back then as well, especially after we had the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, where Trump fired Archibald Cox, the independent prosecutor, as he was called at the time, we had a strong reaction against that from Republicans in Congress. We had a strong reaction from the Supreme Court, which ruled unanimously that he had to turn over his tapes. We had a Howard Baker. We had a Senate majority or a Republican leader in Hugh Scott, a House Republican leader in John Rhodes, a champion of the right in Barry Goldwater, all of whom stepped up to do the right thing when the occasion demanded it. And I wouldn't call Mitch McConnell a Hugh Scott or Paul Ryan a John Rhodes. I don't see a Howard Baker or a Barry Goldwater at this particular moment. And if you don't have impeachment as a remedy, realistically, what do you do? At the same time, I think the idea that the framers intended to have a president being able to pardon himself for anything that he did and get away with it, except for impeachment, takes the pardon power to an absurd and extreme conclusion. And I've suggested in the past that when you look, go back and look at what the framers had to say about the pardon power, just imagine, in a worst-case scenario, that a president orders the murder of his political opponents and then pardons himself. And then imagine that the remedy is impeachment, and they move towards impeaching him, and he murders some of the people who would impeach him and pardons himself. Anybody who believes that the framers would say, well, yeah, that's okay, I think is heading into a point of ridiculousness. The idea that a president can't commit obstruction of justice, even if that's something accepted by his lawyer, and I use the term loosely, John Dowd, I also find absurd. Presidents can and should be held to account. Interestingly, the majority of Republican senators who were around when Bill Clinton was impeached all took that position, as did Jeff Sessions when he was in the Senate. We'll see if they take it now. You know, there are times when, let me step back and put it this way. The definition of high crimes and misdemeanors is not specific and clear. It can include things that are not crimes. And if we have a president, especially given that there are powers here, including the use of nuclear weapons, who is not behaving within the boundaries of decency or the constitutional framework, who poses a clear and present danger to the country, then there are remedies. One is the 25th Amendment. I don't find that to be a particularly credible one, in part because the hurdle is even higher than impeachment. You need not only the cabinet and the majority of the cabinet and the vice president, but two-thirds of both houses to remove a president for anything other than a serious physical ailment. And impeachment then becomes something that you have to keep in mind. And at the moment, given the behavior of Donald Trump, we should very much keep this in mind.
Yeah, well, that's a depressing way to end, but I do hope that if it does come to that, there'll be enough people who would be willing to step up and do the right thing. But again, I sure hope it doesn't come to that. All right. Well, on that sobering note, we will close. Dr. Norman Ornstein, thank you so much again for taking the time to talk with me today.
Sure. You bet.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard and you'll check out today's sponsor, Dollar Shave Club. Get the Dollar Shave Club starter set featuring their executive razor, a full cassette of cartridges, shave butter, body wash, and one wipe Charlie's butt wipes for only $5 by going to dollarshaveclub.com/TPG. Listener support is what helps to keep this show going, and we truly do appreciate it. If you're interested in joining our great group of Politics Guys supporters, you can go to politicsguys.com and click on the Patreon or PayPal links you'll find there. And if you want to support the show without spending anything, you can share this episode with your friends and followers or pass along our new show posts and tweets on Facebook and Twitter. Leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes also helps. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that at mail@politicsguys.com. Or our Facebook page where you can message us and where we post stuff throughout the week. That's facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with the new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.